My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
The Fed kicks off its latest policy meeting. We'll look at its likely next move and how central banks in Japan and China are responding to inflation. Plus, why ocean shipping companies are looking to the skies.
It will give the shipping companies a leg up. The air service has proven to be quite popular with a number of customers.
And election skeptics deploy as poll watchers ahead of November's U.S. midterms. It's Tuesday, September 20th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. Federal Reserve is expected to approve its third consecutive interest rate increase of 0.75% tomorrow, while signaling plans to raise and hold its benchmark rate above 4% in the coming months to battle inflation. Investors see a small chance of a larger rate rise of a full percentage point at the Fed's policy meeting today and Wednesday, but others think surprising the public with a larger rate rise could fuel questions over the central bank's broader strategy and tactics. In other central bank news, the Bank of Japan is expected to maintain ultra-low interest rates when it meets later this week. That follows new government data showing consumer inflation up 3% from a year earlier in August, above a 2% target. Meanwhile, China's central bank today kept its benchmark lending rates unchanged, a move in line with expectations as Beijing seeks to avoid increasing downside pressure on its currency. Wall Street Journal financial markets reporter Chelsea Delaney has more on a busy week for central banks.
The Federal Reserve is one of the most aggressive right now. They're very focused on inflation, even to the detriment of economic growth. Central banks like those in Japan and China are erring more on the side of protecting economic growth. But now both of these are facing a new threat, which is the weakness of their currencies. And that's threatening to add to their inflationary problems because to import things becomes much more expensive. So both of those are also trying to find a middle ground between protecting their currencies by not seeming too dovish while also trying to keep the economy to some degree stimulated.
Protests have spread across Iran over the death of a young woman in police custody who allegedly violated the country's strict Islamic dress code. Demonstrations over the death of Mahsa Amini have seen women removing their state-mandated headscarves in the streets and police responding with force. According to state media, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi ordered the Interior Ministry to investigate Amini's death and called her family on Sunday to express his condolences. The state-run IRNA news agency says that Tehran police have called Amini's death an unfortunate incident and denied that she was mistreated while in custody. The latest protests highlight how restrictions on women have galvanized opposition to the government in Iran, where a large secular population is ruled by ultra-conservative Islamic clerics. Turning to the U.S., a federal judge on Monday ruled against a Justice Department antitrust challenge to United Health Group's $13 billion acquisition of health technology firm Change Healthcare. The court ruling represents an early blow to stepped-up antitrust enforcement by the Biden administration, which sued in February to block the deal. The decision is a triumph for United Health, which owns the largest U.S. health insurer and a healthcare operation. The Justice Department's top antitrust official, Jonathan Cantor, said the department disagreed with the decision and was considering its next steps. And Australian mining giant Fortescue Metals says it will spend more than $6 billion on renewable energy and stop using fossil fuels by 2030. The company says the pledge will lower energy costs and mark a key step toward producing low-carbon steel. It is the first such commitment by a major mining company and follows rising pressure from investors and customers to reduce the environmental impact of raw materials. The world's largest ocean shipping lines have long shunned air freight, concerned it was a distraction from their focus catering to trade on the high seas. But a number of factors have combined to change their minds, and those same firms are increasingly turning to the skies. Wall Street Journal senior reporter Kostas Paris covers global shipping, trade, and logistics for us, and he's here now with a look at this aviation pivot underway. Hey, Kostas.
Hello there.
So what moves are some of the biggest shipping lines making, and which companies in particular are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about two of the bellwethers of the container ship industry, Maersk from Denmark and CMA CGM from France. And they have been looking and buying and investing into air freight since last year. CMA, for instance, pumped 400 million euros into Air France KLM, which is in the process of starting its own air freight business. And they will be using the belly space of the Air France passenger planes and the new freighter planes to share networks and destinations. Maersk, on the other hand, has also started its own air division, and they have 15 777s, which they have leased. They're operated by DHL and UPS, and they will be receiving a number of other planes in coming years, which they will use to move cargo for their own customers, big retailers like Target, Walmart, and Amazon.
Is this an attempt by ocean shipping companies to sort of offer an all-inclusive freight shipping package, if you will? And are air freight companies, in turn, maybe doing the reverse, getting into ocean shipping?
I think it will give the shipping companies a leg up. The air service has proven to be quite popular with a number of customers. So I think they will continue to invest into planes. I don't think that it's the other way around, that airlines are going to invest in ships. The shipping industry is very much consolidated. The five biggest carriers control 85% of what moves across the ocean. So I don't think that this would be the case. But again, it looks like a very good business case for the ocean carriers to invest into air freight.
And yet these same companies hadn't wanted to do this in the past. What's changed?
Well, traditionally air freight and ocean freight, the two ways to move your cargo, were competitors. Air freight was more expensive and it moved more valuable cargo. And those who wanted big quantities, a lot of containers, would go into ships traditionally. Well, the snarls in the supply chain with the blocked ports, the late ships, the shutdown terminals because of COVID, all of these changed the perception. Cargo owners that had priorities like auto parts, heavy machinery, food, medicine, they started sending this kind of cargo through air freight because they wanted to be there on time.
That was Wall Street Journal senior reporter Kostas Paris, who covers global shipping, trade, and logistics for us. Kostas, thanks as always.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, could one of the many things to watch in November's U.S. midterm elections be the poll watchers themselves? We've got that story after the break.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Poll watching is a typically mundane duty in the U.S. election process, but after former President Donald Trump falsely claimed that widespread election fraud cost him the 2020 race, it is emerging as a potential flashpoint ahead of the November midterms, especially as Republicans recruit batches of volunteers to monitor the vote. Wall Street Journal reporter Alexa Kors traveled to Wisconsin, where that recruitment is well underway, and she joins us now with more about what she's been observing. Alexa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us, first off, about the differences between poll workers and poll watchers. What are we really talking about here?
Right. So poll workers are like your typical volunteers who actually run a polling place or help count votes. And then you have poll watchers. And those are people who are there just to observe. And they're often affiliated with a political party. So this isn't a new thing, but we're seeing a lot more attention on poll watching this election cycle than we have in the past.
Yeah, break that down for us. What kind of recruitment activity are we seeing?
We're seeing a lot of focus right now on recruiting poll watchers, especially among Republicans. Some of that's national. So the Republican National Committee says they're recruiting tens of thousands of poll workers and poll watchers. And some of that's local, like county Republican parties or even outside groups.
What would these poll watchers be watching for? And are there clear rules about what they can and can't look for?
So poll watchers are there to observe, to watch for any rule violations. They're supposed to help make sure things are running smoothly. And yes, the specifics depend on the state, but there often are strict rules around what poll watchers can do. So in Wisconsin, for example, poll watchers can't take photos while polls are open. They can't interact with voters unless the voter asks for their help. And intimidating voters is illegal under federal law.
If this recruitment drive is successful, is it clear what effect that might have on the voting process? What are the parties saying here?
So voting rights advocates and Democrats say they're concerned about the potential for these observers to potentially get disruptive. There's also the question that Democrats are raising, what if you have poll watchers who don't trust the election results or the voting system? Are they going to try to interfere? From the Republican point of view, and what the Republicans are saying is that they reject any suggestion that this is wrong or causing trouble. And they say, look, this is a way to increase transparency in the voting process and to give people who have questions a chance to get involved and see the process for themselves.
Are these concerns about the potential effect of poll watchers purely hypothetical, or are there actual instances in the past where there were disruptions?
Some election officials have already said they've seen incidents this year where poll watchers got disruptive. I mentioned in my story some incidents that were reported in North Carolina's primary this year, where election officials said there were incidents like observers trying to talk to voters when they shouldn't have, or harassing election workers.
Is the Democratic Party saying, all right, if Republicans are recruiting tens of thousands of poll watchers, we might as well do the same so that, you know, both parties are represented in the room?
So I spoke to both parties for this story, and it's totally normal for Democratic parties as well to recruit poll watchers. The latest I've heard is that the Democratic National Committee said that they're letting the state parties take the lead as opposed to a more national effort we're hearing about from the Republicans. But it's completely normal, and I would expect to see observers from both parties.
You allude to some of the concerns about what a lot of poll watchers getting involved in this election might mean for the vote. Sounds like you also spoke to some folks who think there could be just an overall upside to this.
Well, I spoke to observers on the Republican side and on the Democratic side who were volunteering in the August primary in Wisconsin. And I spoke to one Republican who told me that he had questions about the 2020 election. He wasn't sure if it was fair. So he decided to go observe this August election for himself. And he actually left feeling confident in that polling place. He was overall pretty happy with how things were run. Now, he said he still had concerns nationally, but at least he was more confident in how things were being run locally.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Alexa Corse. Alexa, thanks for the update.
Thanks so much.
And finally, the travel industry is seeing a rise in bleisure trips, as in trips that see leisure tacked on to business travel. Marriott's CEO says that strong occupancy on Thursday and Sunday nights are proof that guests are extending their stays. And while remote and hybrid work makes these dual-purpose trips more appealing, Wall Street Journal travel reporter Jacob Passy says that bleisure can come with its own headaches, from determining who pays for what or who's responsible if problems arise.
So almost half of companies out there basically don't have any policy about this. And because a lot of this is occurring in a gray area, it puts a lot of the onus on the employees and a lot of that stress on the employees. So if you get in a car accident with the rental car that you rented for your work trip, your company is going to have to do some due diligence to figure out if you're driving for a work function or for your own leisure. If you get sick, if you get COVID, you know, who is responsible for that? So if you don't work for one of the few companies that has really started to embrace this and create rules around it and make it easier, it could could be more challenging than you realize to make this trip happen.
And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.